south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 235, covering the week of October 12th through October 16th, 2020. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media accounts at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. That's A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org. While you're at abbevilleinstitute.org, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's a great book by 20 Southerners, 20 contributors to the Abbeville Institute. And it is our gift to you free of charge simply for giving us an email address. You'll get daily correspondence from us, our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday. And it's a great way that we can keep in touch with you. If you like what we do, you like our podcast, you like our website, you like all the things that we have to offer, you like our new videos, which are a great way to hit back at what's going on. 6-minute history segments. We've got another one coming up in the next couple of weeks. So if you like those things, please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Abbeville Institute. Just click on that support tab at abbevilleinstitute.org. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. If you want to just keep it going every month, you know, we'll take $5 a month. What is $5 a month nowadays? I mean, it doesn't really even get you a cup of coffee anymore. So if you think the Southern tradition is worth a cup of coffee every month, $60 a year, then head on over to abbevilleinstitute.org and help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. You can also click on that support tab and then shop. And of course, you can get your Abbeville Institute apparel. It's high quality embroidered stuff. It's great materials. And you can support the Institute by wearing that material when you're out and about. People ask you about it. You can say, yeah, this is what the Abbeville Institute does. So we've got a lot of great stuff. We do a lot of great things. We've got our free app, which is a great way to keep the Abbeville Institute on the go. Just go to your app store on your mobile device, look for Abbeville Institute, download that application. It's free of charge. Most of what we do is free of charge, but we keep it free of charge because of people like you. And so if you like what we do on a regular basis, consider opening your wallet to help us out. It's the only way we can keep all these things free of charge. All right. That said, please rate the podcast wherever you get podcasts. Also, share our material around on social media. You know, do all those things you can do to help us out, because that's how we continue to grow and reach more people. All right, so let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. And it has a lot to do with reconciliation, this idea of reconciliation. I've mentioned it a lot on this podcast. You see, at the end of the war, there certainly was a vindictive stripe to the political conditions that existed in the United States when the war was over. You had the South defeated, prostrated. You had people that wanted the South punished. You had people that wanted people like Lee and Jefferson Davis hung as traitors. I mean, these people were there. Most Americans, though, the majority of, did not believe that. The majority of Americans did not believe in punishing the South in that particular way. You see, this was a constitutional question that was supposedly answered by force of arms, though I could say that that's not necessarily the case. You can never really answer a legal question by force of arms. But regardless, we had a situation where Southerners were defeated and then were faced with the prospects of what that defeat meant, the political, economic, social prospects of what that meant. And this led to Reconstruction. Now, during that time, during military Reconstruction, you had a lot of hardships in the South. You had governments that were not controlled by Southerners or native Southerners at times. You had the complete social order of the South turned upside down. And whether we think that's good or bad now, at the time, no other place in the United States was facing this. You had these were big questions. How do you deal with 3 million people, half of whom are now going to be able to vote, or about half that can vote, that could never vote before? Never really even had any education. How do you deal with that situation? How do you bring these people into society? This is something people had talked about, North and South, to this point, for a couple of hundred years. How do you do it? How do you do it in a way that's not going to create a violent problem in the South? Even Abraham Lincoln was wrestling with this, which is why he supported colonization up until the day he died. He was still promoting it. The historian Phil Magnus has shown this, I think, conclusively in a very good book about this topic, that Lincoln was still in favor of colonization until the day he died. He didn't drop that idea. He thought this was something that probably needed to happen. So the amazing thing that came out of all this, I think, is that at one point, when Reconstruction's over, you get to the 1880s, you get to the 1890s, the early 20th century, and you have this reconciliation period. You have a period of time where the hatchet is buried, that Northerners and Southerners shake hands, they go back to resuming the Union the way it was before the war. But maybe even better, because they both respected each other's traditions and positions during the war. The South was just, Southerners were just trying to be good Americans. They were fighting in the Spanish-American War. They were fighting in World War I. They were just trying to do their part. They joined hands in many cases with progressives of the North and the West, or agrarians of the North and West, people that were not very happy about the Hamiltonian economic system that had been foisted on the United States, this very Jeffersonian strain. So they joined hands together and they beat that back. Southerners recognized Abraham Lincoln as a great man, and Northerners recognized Robert E. Lee as a great man. Now, if you listen to reconciliation told today, well, it's a great tragedy because Black Americans were left behind. Black Americans were left to fend for themselves. And of course, then you had the rise in racial violence across the United States, which that part of it is true. I mean, you did have a rise in racial violence across the United States, not just in the South, but in the Midwest, the West, even in the Mid-Atlantic region as well. So you had this period of time where, you know, it said, well, Blacks were left to fend for themselves. And that's true. I mean, this happened. But you got out of that a spirit of reconciliation that was different from any time in American history. And I think that reconciliation is gone. It's all gone. You also had a large number of Black property owners in the South after the war. And you started seeing an affluent section of American society, Black Americans who had money, and Black Americans who were doing well in certain parts of the United States. Even in the South, you had that. So you have all these untold stories. You had Booker T. Washington, for example, in the South, financed in many ways by Northern money, but Southerners still were part of this. And in Macon County, Alabama, where Tuskegee Institute is located, Washington voted all the time. He never couldn't vote. He voted. And so this is where you had pockets in the South of these different kind of things. Why? Why did you have that? Well, again, because people had generally decided that, well, the war was bad, slavery was bad, we're glad it's over, we're back to being friends again, we're just going to move forward, we've got that issue off the table, so let's get back to resuming what makes America strong, and let's build our economy. And let's understand history as what it is. I mean, it's, you know, you had a very terrible time. 1 million people were killed. You had tremendous upheaval out of this. But let's get back to just studying history and trying to understand the past and not demonizing anybody, not saying anybody was terrible. Maybe it was vindictive and bad for us to call this. I mean, maybe we punished the South too hard. You have Charles Francis Adams standing up in 1907 and saying we need a statue of Robert E. Lee. Why? Because we punished the South too hard during Reconstruction. That shouldn't have happened. And you have Southerners producing wonderful works, and Northerners as well, on Southern history that are trying to critically examine what the South was and what Southern society was, and not really pulling any punches. I mean, they're saying negative things about the South. I mean, Southerners start to look at themselves, look at their own section, what was labor like in the South, what was life like in the South, and an objective way, not a subjective way, where you have Northerners writing Uncle Tom's Cabin. So you have this going on, and this is where the Barbara Marthal piece is very interesting to me. And we published this on Thursday. And Barbara Marthal is an African-American. And she speaks at our conferences. She's really good. And she says, look, Yeah, I mean, you've got these things that happened in the South. We all know that there was things that were bad in the South. We all know that stuff. We know there was violence in the South, racial violence in the South. We know there was, you know, whether it was in the antebellum period or postbellum period. But let's look at the positive things about this. What were some of the positive things we can point to, and where are the healing sides of these things that we can work with and say, you know, there was a lot going on here besides that. Let's not focus on the guilt and shame of these things. Let's focus on the positive elements of a multiracial society in the South, which there was much there. Let's do that instead. Let's find the common ground rather than the negativity, rather than the discordant part of Southern history, and let's start working together. It's a spirit of reconciliation that's sorely lacking. You're going to get our newsletter if you're a donor to the Institute, and a printed newsletter where I wrote a little piece talking about that. You know, when Martin Luther King stood up and said, we want Southerners, the sons of former slaveholders and the sons of former slaves, to sit down, you know, to essentially break bread together. That was a reconciliationist message. That's all it was. And most people in the South had already been doing this. A friend of mine points this out. He said, you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on. He grew up in Tuskegee as a minority, in his case, in Tuskegee. And he said, most people got along just fine. There wasn't really anything going on here. That's how the South normally operated. But to the outside, it didn't look that way. So what she's advocating is, look, let's take the guilt and shame out of this. Let's build bridges using some of the terms of the left. Let's build bridges, not canyons between us. Let's find the common ground. Let's not demonize each other. Let's not tear down monuments. Let's not do these things because that's divisive. You really want to point to divisiveness? That's it. Monuments were put up because North and South had decided they were going to shake hands at Gettysburg and say, you guys fought your way, we fought our way, let's celebrate our heroes, we'll call each other's heroes, and we'll all be Americans again. Now that is what is actually being attacked today in America. And when you look at the piece that we published on Friday, Black Confederates and Reconstruction Newspapers, you can't say these things anymore. You've got Kevin Levine's book out about, you know, the myth of Black Confederates. And you have all these people running around. Black Confederates is a myth. Well, I mean, Shane Anderson has gone out and just looked at newspapers and found all kinds of accounts out there of people talking about Black Confederates, whether it was during the war or after the war. People are talking about it. So if that's the case, if you can find just one, well, Black Confederates existed. And he's very honest. He says, look, I can't tell you there's a whole slew of Black Confederates. I can't tell you there's regiments. I mean, we know in 1865 there was a couple raids in Richmond. I can't tell you any of that. But we do know Blacks supported the war. How many? That's unknown. But enough so that people were talking about it after the war was over. Northerners were complaining that Blacks didn't support them enough. Well, why? I mean, they were saying, look, why didn't they break all their farm tools? Why didn't they rebel? Why didn't they revolt against slave owners? They didn't do it. They didn't do it at all. They didn't do any of that stuff, even though Lincoln tried to encourage it with the initial Emancipation Proclamation. None of that happened. So why? Why didn't that happen? Why did some Black Southerners go out and fight with the Confederacy? Was it because they were scared and that they thought they would be killed if they didn't? I mean, this is the image that you get from these leftists who write these histories of the period, but maybe there's something more to it. This is a forbidden topic, and it shouldn't be. If we really want to have reconciliation, we want to value Black contributions to American society. What about these Black Southerners that did this? Why can't we talk about that? Why can't, I mean, Henry Louis Gates has come out and said, hey, look, it looks like there's Black Confederates. That's part of Black history in America. I mean, why don't we talk about these things? Because it doesn't fit a narrative. The narrative has to be the South is the root of everything bad in America, and it has to be done away with. And if there was a Black person that supported these things, well, they have to be completely destroyed. Barbara Marthal would not be allowed to speak at any of these modern leftist organizations, even though she's very much interested in racial reconciliation. She's very much interested in promoting racial healing and diversity and talking about all things that black contributions to America. She's really interested in this stuff, but yet because she doesn't have the accepted standard 3x5 index, as Tom Woods says, 3x5 index card, acceptable, allowable opinion on black history, well, she's not going to be allowed. Because she doesn't accept the victim narrative of black society, black modern American society, she can't be allowed. So something else has to happen. This is tragic. It's tragic because it avoids, it creates a climate of hostility. And that's what the Institute, of course, is trying to educate people, that it doesn't have to be that way. Black and white Southerners do have a lot in common. In fact, many times more in common than white Northerners and white Southerners. Culturally, there's a lot more in common. So it doesn't have to be adversarial. And I think that's why Barbara Martha's so good. And this piece by Shane Anderson saying, look, I mean, there's these people out there. Do we deny their history? Do we deny their role in Southern society? Because if we say they don't exist, we're denying, we're actually saying that we're going to tell you these people's histories and not them. We're denying their history. I remember there was a video that Time, I think it was A&E or one of these companies put out, and it was on ancient civilizations. One of them was on Zimbabwe. And it talked about, the title was, I think it was Zimbabwe, A History Denied. And it was scathing. These people had a great history, and all it was is white cultural imperialism that said that we're going to deny their history. Well, what is Levine doing by saying that black Confederates didn't exist? He is denying a history to people. Is that not the same thing as white cultural imperialism? Is that not what it is? I mean, look, this is here. This exists. Yeah, these things exist. These other things, these hard things existed too. These bad things existed. Nobody's denying any of that. But where is the common ground? What can we find? If we really want to be honest about history, this is what Fogel and Engerman essentially did, and Eugene Genovese in their studies of slavery, for example. If we're going to be honest about these things and look at them, you know, Ulrich B. Phillips, who was racist, of course, but people have had a hard time taking Phillips apart because he did a lot of the work in the archives. And there's a number of others. Fogel and Engerman simply went out and looked at the sources. They looked at the source material and said, this is what the sources lead us. This is the conclusion that the material leads us to. We don't say that slavery was a good institution. We're not. And it's amazing because they tell a story about these things. You know, after conferences, people would come up and say, so you're telling me that you're defending slavery? I mean, they weren't in any way, shape, or form. They're just telling you what the evidence suggests. That stuff you can't say anymore because of a leftist or neo-Marxist political and intellectual agenda. That stuff has to be eliminated because it does not fit the narrative. That's the end of reconciliation, as we had a couple of pieces talk about this week. John Marcourt and Casey Chalk. John Marcourt, one of our resident scholars from Japan. 1619 plus 2020 equals 1984. And the erasure of history and how this is what's being erased. We're erasing reconciliation and replacing it with what? Violent retribution? We're replacing it with nastiness. We're replacing it with history that is done for a purpose, to set an agenda. This is what we're replacing it with. This is what we want to do in America. These are the things we want to do in America, is create an environment that's hostile to each other. Well, certainly I think the left wants that. You create antagonisms, you create sides, and then you let those sides beat each other up, and then you gain power because you supposedly have the moral authority and the moral superiority. This is what they think. This is the Yankee in them. And I'm going to get to the piece on Wednesday by Valerie Hughes, or Valerie Protopapas, who is simply saying this exact same thing. So you've got John Marcourt talking. We've talked about the 1619 Project. It's not history. It's an agenda. It's an agenda. And certainly, I mean, you could say, well, there's certain parts of it that are true. And you can't get around that. And the attacks have been that, you know, stretching the truth a little bit on the American War for Independence and placing Black Americans at the center of everything in America is a little bit disingenuous, or maybe a lot disingenuous. But that's the point. It doesn't mean that there's not merit to some of the things that the articles talk about. Attacking Abraham Lincoln, for example, for being a colonizationist and other things. And certainly the British did say, and I've said it on this podcast, that you know, maybe Americans are fighting for slavery in 1776. Now, we can say that's false, but the British certainly made the accusation. So, look, I mean, we can talk about these things. All ideas can be discussed. But when you use it as a weapon, as Hannah Jones has done with the piece, it's history as a weapon, that's when you get into dangerous territory. And so the piece on Tuesday by Casey Chalk talks about a book that was written in response to the 1619 Project. It's Peter Wood's 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. And it's a very short book. And of course, he points out 1620 was the real beginning of America, because that's Plymouth. Now, I would say this. I think that's, again, a little disingenuous. 1620 wasn't the founding of America. And I think Casey Chalk does a good point of saying, well, you still got Virginia in here. You know, you can't say, and this is where we had Lyon Gardner Tyler talking about, you know, Virginia first. Virginia was first in all of this. The first Thanksgiving held in Virginia, the first representative government in Virginia, the first people arrived in Virginia. But to say that 1619 is the founding of America. Now, what's interesting about that is a couple of things were actually in 1619. So I can buy 1619 as being a really important time. But regardless, to say that 1619 is the founding and then to say 1620, that's a little bit of a Yankee domination. But I do like Casey Chalk. He says this, this ultimately brings us back to the legacy of the Old Dominion. The founding fathers of Virginia were by no means perfect. Indeed, practically all of them were slave owners whose wealth was to a significant degree attributed to the coerced labor of blacks who worked their plantations. Yet, these men's positive influence in America is hard to exaggerate. Separation of powers, the promotion of religious liberty, the very military success of the American revolutionaries, among many of the other great accomplishments, are all attributed to these Virginians. This is a historical fact. He says, Hannah Jones and the New York Times have offered us a pseudo-history that ignores the truth that it was the West, and even to a great degree America, that first disparaged and sought to end slavery. Indeed, Vermont was the first government in world history to abolish slavery in its constitution. Hannah Jones and her collaborators are indifferent to such facts, even if they know them. They're too busy hijacking the American political experiment and trying to drive it into a ditch for their own narrow, self-serving goals. Southern educators and thinkers must beware of these ideologues whose project is similar to is detrimental to what is left of our national civic cohesion, one formed by both whites and blacks, Southerners in Virginia and pilgrims in Massachusetts. If we don't stop this fundamentally anti-American propaganda campaign, it will in time destroy us all. We're going to end reconciliation. That's the point. We're going to end reconciliation. So, you know, I think that Casey Chalk did a good job with that. And let's talk about this last piece, A Simple Explanation by Valerie Protopapas, just talking about the difference between the North and the South, and I'll wrap it up with that. And this is very short, so I'm going to read it. She says, what separated the Jeffersonian understanding of government embraced by the South from the philosophy of Lincoln and the people of the North? For if Lincoln had believed as Jefferson, the war would not have happened. Indeed, it is probable that the circumstances leading up to the war would not have happened. So what in fact did happen? Truth to tell, there were two philosophies of government, or rather of the nature of man, that undergirded North and South. The South held to the Aristotelian philosophy that later articulated by Locke, that man was a communal being who naturally created groups in which to live. Within those groups, government was necessary, but only to provide protection for the citizenry. The creed of this philosophy was voiced by Jefferson: government governs best that governs least. The other philosophy of government arose from the teachings of British philosopher Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes opined that man was not a communal being, but rather, like the tiger, man was a solitary, making his way as best he could as a practitioner of the law of the jungle, that is, the survival of the fittest. Therefore, in order for a man to be civilized, he had to be forced into a relationship with his fellows, and that relationship could only be sustained through coercion. Naturally, the only means by which such coercion could be applied was government. Thus, government was the means by which civilization and society were maintained. If there were no central government, or if that government was weak and thus coercion not efficacious, the result would be the social and political chaos. This was the philosophy of Abraham Lincoln and his political allies. Secession of the Southern states meant to Lincoln, besides the loss of revenue, the beginning of a breakup of what had been, to that time, an ever-expanding union. This, in turn, would lead to a weakening of central authority and hence anarchy, something which simply could not be permitted. Anything and everything needful to prevent that breakup was acceptable in light of the unmitigated disaster that would follow a weakening of the central authority and its ability to force a naturally unruly populace into submission. No act was too barbarous, no crime too egregious to be shunned if by its commission the Union was preserved. This mindset answers many questions about the Union strategy of total war and why the people of the North did not cavil or later repent of the commission of such atrocities because they were seen as necessary. Of course, Lincoln as a Hobbesian was not talking about union as most men understood it then, or now for that matter. A true union is by very nature voluntary. Union at the point of a gun is conquest, occupation, and subjugation. Lincoln's definition of union was the submission of the American people, North and South, to the will of the central government. And under that arrangement, the states became nothing more than counties within a national government. And as counties have no separate powers within their states, so states then have no separate powers within the central government, but become bureaucratic entities used for the collection of revenues and the imposition of federal laws, mandates, and regulations. This, is, in effect, what happened as a result of the War of 1861. Lincoln and Hobbes won, Aristotle, Locke, and Jefferson lost, and so did the vision of the founders and we the people. Besides explaining how and why a ruinous war came about when sovereign states exercised their constitutional right to depart from a union that was no longer to their collective benefits, it also explains what is going on 150 years later as the same questions arise again as Jefferson Davis prophesied. Indeed, the major question remains, who rules? We the people or the government? I think this article nicely summarized the situation we were seeing in 1861 to 1865, and explains still to this day the two conflicting visions of America in many ways, the nationalist and the other, the Jeffersonian position and the nationalist position, Lincolnian position, as Dr. Livingston talks about. One's Lincolnian, one's Jeffersonian. We're living in that Lincolnian union of what? And it's become destructive. As we talk about top-down central authority, one-size-fits-all government, this is the real problem in America today and why the Abbeville Institute exists. We exist to try to talk about this Jeffersonian side of things, to talk about what really matters in American political society, which is decentralization. We're going to have a wonderful piece next week by Don Livingston on secession and decentralization. I think you're really going to enjoy it. But the fact is, we're in a political community with people that don't necessarily get along, and that's reconciliation. It's gone. Reconciliation is what has been destroyed by the modern left. That is what they're taking apart. That's what they're attacking more than anything else. It's not the war. It's not the war. It's the outcome of the war. It's people writing histories like how the South won the Civil War. The South supposedly won because we had reconciliation. You see, just by that simple phrase, these people want the South punished. And the only way to continue to do it is to tear down everything Southern, to tear down Confederate monuments, to tear down Southern society, to leave it basically to food and music and maybe a few scattering poems here and there, to co-opt people like George Washington or Edgar Allan Poe as really American, not necessarily Southern. Thomas Jefferson can be Southern because of the Sally Hemings myth. But Washington, no. He has to be an American, so we have to keep him at least as a useful tool. You have to keep these things. We're going to tear everything else down in the South, though. And even music can't necessarily be Southern music anymore. It has to be country music. This is what it means. All right. So, reconciliation is the key. This is why I talk about it so much. Until next time, good day.